You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM at the University of British Columbia Point Grey Campus in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, located on the traditional ancestral unceded territory of the Musqueam people. Welcome to the Lisa Lafferty Podcast, an exploration into the world of theater through a series of conversations with the talented and eclectic group of accomplished playwrights and theater artists from New York, Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto, London, England, and Saskatoon. Episode 3. David J. Diamond of New York is the host of an annual International Directors Symposium and Playwright Retreat in Spoleto, Italy. Lisa Lafferty and David J. Diamond.
David Diamond, welcome to my podcast.
Well, thanks, Lisa. I'm happy to be here.
I'm talking to you. You're in New York City, and I met you through a theater company called La Mama that does a wonderful symposium in Italy, and we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. I want to talk a little bit more. I just want to find out some more about David Diamond. You self-identify as a creative arts leadership fellow, a career coaching for artists, and theater without borders. So just tell me a little bit about the day of David Diamond. What is it that you do and why?
Good questions. What I do every day is different, which is kind of the way I like it. I like having a variety of different projects that I'm working on simultaneously. But the why of it really comes down to the same basic questions. I have certain questions in my mind about things in the world. I'm always trying to figure them out, and I think I try to figure them out by making things, by creating opportunities to learn and to mentor others. Questions that have been longer lasting in my mind involve things like, how does a person who wants to express themselves as an artist have a life and a career that is satisfying and they can live, you know, an adequate lifestyle? So this is a question that goes way back to when I used to run the Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation, which in the U.S. is a part of the Stage Directors Union, and at the Stage Directors Foundation, as executive director, my job was to create programs and run programs to help directors develop in their craft and also in their careers.
So that is just a fabulous question. How does one make a living? And it's actually my last question on the podcast, but we can start with it if you want, because that is your career. How does one make a living?
That's one of the questions that I deal with is how do directors in particular, but all artists, create the work that they want to present? How do they learn the skills and tools necessary to fully express the ideas, the questions, the concerns, the provocations that they want to have? So in doing something like the La Mama Umbria program, that involves bringing a lot of people together to learn from each other, new ways of creating, new ways of building a play, new ways of making theater. And in that way, I get to see how a lot of other people do it. And everybody who's there, as may have happened for you, you get to experience different perspectives on making work and being creative artists. So that to me is a really interesting question. Where does creativity come from? How do we navigate it and use the best of our own creativity to create the work that will most effectively present our ideas and our questions and our thinking so that we can share that with another group of people and get response and see what kind of conversations are generated from that. So,
I love the finding the tools that they need to create the work that they want to create. How do you delve into somebody's psyche to get that stuff out of there?
I guess the best way to find the tools that are best for you is to try on a lot of different tools and try using a bunch of different things and see which ones feel comfortable and feel learnable, if you want to use a word like that. Because I always think that people are afraid to use certain tools that they're not familiar with until they become familiar with them. And once they become familiar with them, then they're like, oh yeah, that's something that I do. But until you know what they are, and you have the full range of perspective on all the possibilities, it's really difficult to know which ones to choose. So you try on different things, you try different methods, you you, you know, that's what rehearsal and learning and education to me are all about. It's trying and making mistakes and learning and shedding some things and adding other things and consistently building upon everything that you've learned so that when you need them, the tools that you need are there at your fingertips.
Have you ever directed a play?
Have I directed a play? Yeah, I started out as a director. When I finished grad school at NYU, I got my master's, and I started directing plays. And I started a theater company with some colleagues and friends, as a lot of us do, called the Barrow Group Theater Company, and it just celebrated its 30th anniversary. So it's still ongoing.
Because it sounds like the work that you do is directing. I mean, you're taking a person, an artist, and treating them like a piece of clay, and you ask them questions and give them tools until you find out what the art is inside.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I have this conversation with some other directors frequently about how they make plays. For example, a friend, Tina Landau, who was very steeped in The Viewpoints, actually The Viewpoints book, was written by she and Ann Bogart. And she and I talk about how when she's creating a play using The Viewpoints, Viewpoints was created by Mary Overly and then adapted by Ann Bogart and Tina Landau later on. But it's a way of working with actors. And it's about all the people on stage being so attuned to each other that they can change their physicality and their emotionality, the drama of the piece, whatever, at a moment's notice, depending on the reaction of what's going on with the other people. It's about really being attuned to what everybody else around you is doing. And I think that directors in their careers need to have that same kind of ability to shift and change according to what's going on in the world. Viewpoints is a method of working with actors to keep them agile and aware of everything going on around them. The way I work with directors is helping them to see how they need to be as agile as they respond to the world around them and present the work through the plays that they direct. So there are a lot of similarities between, I think, directing and the kind of work I do.
Actually, my dad was a lawyer, and my sister is a teacher, and I always found a lot of similarities between my directing and what their jobs were, too, just organizing and inspiring people to do their best and bring out what's good about them. Now, you started off with a how do we make a living at this. What does that look like, those series of questions?
Well, that's, you know, that's the big question that is on everybody's mind when they come to talk to me about this, about lives and careers of artists. And it's a question that I come at from a slightly different way than I think a lot of other people do. My perspective on it is that you don't go from the making a living part first, but I think the first exploration has to be about understanding who you are as an artist and what it is you want to say, and then figuring out the best way to make that happen, and then aligning yourself with other people, colleagues, audience, other artists who kind of get you, understand what you're doing, and want to be part of that, and then creating the thing that you want to be creating, being aware that there is value in what you're doing. And therefore, ultimately, that artistic product has a value to other people who then need to express that value by paying you money. it comes back to the money part and the, you know, sustaining yourself as an artist part. But I think it has to begin from understanding who you are and what you want to really talk about in through your work.
That certainly was my experience in going to La Mama as well, just directors from all around the world and going deeply into their work or workshops that reflect their work. And by the end of it, my work was deeply impacted by that. And I still use today some of the tools I used from these international folks that you hire and bring into Italy. Now, let's talk a little bit about, let's start with Alan Stewart. Can you tell me a little bit about Alan Stewart?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Alan Stewart was a very big influence in my life, a mentor to me as I was developing in this business. But Ellen Stewart grew up, as I did, in Chicago, although in a very different time. She was born in, I think it was 1919. She was born into the south side of Chicago to a very poor family. They were okay. I mean, she got by. And during her formative years, she developed a strong interest in design. As she was thinking about careers, she got very interested in fashion design, designing clothing. Her mother used to make clothes, repair clothes at home while she was growing up. So when Ellen got to be old enough to feel that she wanted to leave Chicago, she wanted to study fashion design. And there were only two places in those days that would take an African-American woman as a student in fashion design. And though one of those places was in L.A. and one was in New York. So she decided to go to New York and find the school and, you know, start her education on that. But what she found out when she got there was that it was very difficult for her to find her way there. And initially, she found St. Patrick's Cathedral, and feeling very confused about what to do, she, and very, very religious, she went into St. Patrick's Cathedral and prayed. And when she left, she walked outside, and across the street from St. Patrick's is Saks Fifth Avenue. She went there and she applied for a job. The only job that women of color could get in those days in Saks Fifth Avenue was as a porter or an elevator operator. So she took the job she could get as a porter, and she would wear this little blue smock over her clothes to work every day. And on the weekends, she would travel around the city of New York, and she discovered the Lower East Side and Orchard Street, where all these push carts were in the street, and everybody was selling everything, the big marketplace down there, very different now. And she developed a friendship with a family that sold fabric. And this guy, her Papa Diamond, she'd call him, was a fabric salesman, and he gave her pieces of fabric that she would then take home and make into the clothes that she would wear to work. Well, people started to notice the clothes she was wearing when she would take her smock off. People would see her, and they'd say, well, where can I get that dress? And she would say, well, you can't buy this dress because I just, you know, made this for myself. And this kept happening until one woman at Saks Fifth Avenue convinced the management that they had to hire her as a designer. So she became the first African-American woman to have her own atelier at Saks Fifth Avenue. And she started making clothes for Saks Fifth Avenue. But the problem was nobody would work for her. The black people thought she was, you know, beyond her station, you know, taking this fancy job. And the white people certainly weren't going to work for her. But fortunately, there was a program at that time to find jobs for immigrants who were flooding in from Eastern Europe after World War II. And the women, these mostly Eastern European Jewish women, were the seamstresses. And they're the ones that started calling her mama. That's one of the reasons I told this long story, is the mama in there, because that was just what they called her. And it sort of stuck, and people started calling her mama. She ended up designing clothes for Bergdorf Goodman, Bendel's, Couture Collection. She had leisure wear. She developed her own line of clothes for a while. When Queen Elizabeth had her inauguration, two of the women attending wore gowns that Ellen had designed. She was offered an atelier in Paris, which she turned down, and she just kept working and becoming quite successful until her foster brother and his friends were complaining to her one day that they were writing plays and they couldn't get their plays produced. And she, not knowing anything about theater, said, what does it mean to produce a play? They said, well, you have to have a space and light and costumes, and you have to have seating and all these different things. And she said, well, maybe I can help with that. So she rented a space on 2nd Avenue in the Lower East Side, and she started to make it into what would be a little theater. But the problem was it wasn't zoned for that, and soon the city zoning inspector came by and said to her, you cannot put a theater in this space. And she was lamenting the fact that she was already, you know, building it out, and all these young men were there. Her fashion model friends were like, mama, where does this go? Mama, where do I do, you know, where do I put this? And this guy comes in from the city planning department, and he was actually a former actor, as it turned out. And he said to her, you know, if you make this into a cafe, then you could actually do performances here. she said, okay, then I'll do that. You just have to serve a cup of coffee, then you can make it in a cafe, you could do performances. And the paperwork, yeah, they say, well, what's the name? And so people are saying, Mama, where does this go? Mama, where does that go? And he writes down, Mama's, Cafe Mama. And then they're looking at it, and he goes, oh, no, that's not fancy enough. That's too mundane. Call it Cafe La Mama. And that's where La Mama came from, which soon had moved from there to another location and moved to many locations before landing at 74 East 4th Street, where the main theater is now. But what Ellen discovered as she started producing these people's plays is that more and more playwrights kept coming to her and saying, oh, are you that? You're that lady in the East Village that's, you know, producing people's plays. Here's my play. Do my play. And she started doing plays by people like Sam Shepard and Terrence McNally and a lot of these young writers, you know, Harvey Fierstein, a lot of people who were not getting their plays produced. People started coming to see them, and La Mama became this little itinerant company that was moving around the East Village wherever they could find a space and being a home for these playwrights. La Mama became an international theater, and one of the reasons was plays were not getting reviewed and they were having trouble getting them published. And somebody told Ellen that if you go to Europe and you get reviews in Europe, then that will have an impact on what happens in New York. So she took a company with a bunch of different playwrights and some actors, and they went to Europe to a couple of different festivals and started getting the plays reviewed. And what she noticed when she was in Europe was that there were lots of really interesting artists whose work she saw there that were not being done in New York. And she started to invite people like Peter Brook and Jerzy Kotowski and all these artists that she encountered to come to her theater in New York and present plays there. And it started this whole international relationship that she developed with artists around the world. And she really went to at least 50 different countries in her lifetime, taking shows and then finding new artists and bringing them back to New York and presenting them. And so La Mama today is 4 different performance venues in on East 4th Street that show new work by American writers, that show international work, that show work using all different kinds of modern technologies that are always at the cutting edge of experimentation. So it's still a really vital and exciting place, and it really has continued with her idea, even at the now that she's gone.
She really did feel like a mama. I thought that was an appropriate name for her.
You got a chance to meet her and talk with her while you were at La Mama, right, in Italy?
Not only did I get a chance to talk with her, but she chose our play to work on, so we worked on the play. And with me as the director, the play, Drinking with Persephone, it's called, written by Jen Griffin. It was really about a young girl growing up in Edmonton, but it had this Greek connection. And I think that's what attracted Ellen to it, although it's a brilliantly written play as well. And so she basically took the words out. She had the dancers and the singers, all of us, all directors, all just doing something that we enjoyed and bringing it to the piece until the whole room was just alive with sound and music, telling this story in a completely different way. And I remember distinctly when we got to the end of it, she was so pleased it had gone so well. Oh, wasn't that fantastic? And I said, yeah, that was fantastic. Okay, great. She thought it was a wrap. And I said, well, that felt like a rehearsal. I want to do it again. And she said, okay, let's do it again. You're the director. Let's do it one more time. Yes, it was very good. What is it that got Ellen into the American Theater Hall of Fame and then the MacArthur Genius Grant?
Well, I think that the genius of Ellen and I think the Theater Hall of Fame and the Tony Award and all that stuff that came later was, you know, in response to her whole lifetime of work. She worked at La Mama and ran La Mama for almost 50 years. She died, I think, in the 49th year of the company. But I think that the genius part was her ability to connect to really interesting artists and then to almost do what she did with you and with the other artists that I've seen her interact with, was put, you know, give a different perspective on how you tell a story. So how you can tell a story, yes, through language, and she often used language in the plays that she did, and a lot of plays at La Mama are steeped in great language, but also what else can you do? Like, what is the music? What is the dance? What are the other elements of theatrical presentation? A lot of shows have puppetry. A lot of shows have video. A lot of shows have other aspects that can be used. And her genius really was to find, you know, Andre Serban as a young boy in Romania and bring him to New York. And then he became, you know, huge doing the Trojan Women and the whole Greek trilogy that he did here. And then putting interesting people together, because he put her together with Elizabeth Suedos, who wrote the music for those pieces. And that synergy made something extraordinary. So her genius was really through her interaction with people and how sensitive she was to who they were as artists, what they needed as artists, and also what would make them better as artists.
And that's also something that made her internationally successful with the tours, right? Is you can take the language out and still tell the story.
Yes. She always used to say, "I'm Chinese," and which she obviously isn't or wasn't, but she would say, "I have to be able to understand what's going on the stage, even if I don't understand the language." So you're right. Yeah, touring was a big part of it.
We've teased a little bit about Spoleto, Italy, and La Mama there. So there's a beautiful nunnery renovated and turned into this artist retreat. Tell me some more about the beautiful, beautiful thing that is La Mama in Spoleto, Italy.
Yes, my heart is there, and is always, probably always will be. But Ellen found this wreck of a building when she got the MacArthur Genius Grant in the late 80s, and she decided to turn it into this artist residence. So as you recall, there's like there's a stage that we built outside in the field, there's a rehearsal studio, gallery space, and she tried to decorate and design everything in a way that really was reflective of her and her travels around the world, all the different theaters she'd been to and the people she had met. So it's beautifully, you know, designed. First of all, she was a designer. Then she started to, with a lot of us helping out, bring really interesting artists to do different kinds of programs. So the programs we have now, we still have the directing symposium, the one you attended, which is now going into its 18th year. And extraordinary artists come every year. Last summer was an amazing year with Lee Brewer and Maud Mitchell from Mabu Mine, Basil Twist, the puppeteer, Yoshiko Chuma, the Japanese choreographer, Tian Mancha from China, Martha Clark from the U.S., Nube Sandoval and Bernardo Rey from Colombia, Sanjoy Ganguly from India, bringing together people from all over the world to share their unique way of making theater. And then we have the Playwright Retreat, which is an opportunity for playwrights to have a quiet, comfortable place where they don't have to worry about anything except writing and being in this, surrounded by this beautiful countryside. And there's a master playwright in attendance who gives them certain kinds of provocation or bonds to their work or some kind of workshop. Our newest program is called Next Generation, and I'm really excited about this one. We started it last summer, and it's about the new performance-generating incubator for younger artists, younger meaning 35 and under. And they have to propose a particular project they're going to work on at La Mama Umbria, and then we select, last summer it was 8 projects that were in rehearsal simultaneously around the property, and people would go in and see each other's rehearsals and use each other in their work and start to collaborate, but they all had an opportunity to develop the whatever work they were doing in their own way, in their own time. And then we brought in some master artists for feedback if they wanted it. They didn't have to take it, but if they wanted it, then yes, you'd have that as a resource. And it was fascinating to see what happened. I mean, there were artists from 5 different countries, and they were all doing completely different kinds of work. But the most extraordinary part for me was how they met each other and interacted with each other in such a supportive and helpful and not competitive way.
It truly is a magical place. And when you say, really, all you have to worry about is the art, you guys do the laundry and the food. Oh, my goodness, the food is just unbelievable. And it just keeps coming. But you say you have people from all over the world. And it occurred to me this morning on my way in, I was thinking, you know, it's such a variety of people all coming to this one magical place. Is there something that we all have in common?
The people that come? Yeah. I always say the people that show up are the people that really belong there or need to be there at that moment. And I think what they all have in common is a desire to be the best artist they could be. They really, really want to be better at what they do. They come there to learn and to exchange with other people, collaborate, and to really go deeper so that they can emerge as the best artist that they could be.
And how's the Canadian contingency going these days?
We get Canadian. Most years, I think there's not always. I would certainly love to have more Canadian participation. I don't know if you know the Canadian artist Liang Ti Tu. She was a participant in the symposium, and then she taught Chinese opera technique during one of the directing symposiums later on. So she's one who's been like at least three times. And of course, you know, Dmitry Chabovsky, Jen Griffin, and yourself, we're all always happy when you guys are there. If you have suggestions or ideas about how to reach out to more Canadian artists, I would welcome that. That would be great.
Okay, good. I did come across it sort of accidentally on a Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas newsletter. So maybe there could be something that we could get into more of the newsletters around the country. So as a New Yorker, what is your impression of Canadian theater in New York?
That's interesting because the one thing about Canadian theater in New York is that we often don't know it's Canadian theater in New York because it's not promoted all the time as this is Canadian theater, this is a Canadian group, you know. So a lot of times things will come and I'll see them, but I won't even realize ever or not till I just, you know, read the program that this was Canadian, unless it's like Cirque du Soleil or something. But at Soho Rep, I have seen a production of Winners and Losers, Marcus Youssef and James Long. Because they were Canadian, and one of my students at Columbia, Michael Scholar Jr., his company is November Theater in Edmonton, and he was friends with Marcus and James, and so I was able to bring them into my class at Columbia. I got to speak to the class. Because of Michael, actually, he started to point, oh, the Canadian artist is coming to New York, or that Canadian artist is coming. So when I know somebody who's Canadian, they let me know.
Oh, that's excellent. Good networking there. Is there anything else that I should have asked you?
Would be interesting to talk about these days is the international relationships and connections through theater that are going on that I see through my work with Theater Without Borders. Theater Without Borders is a fascinating non-organization. It's basically a group of colleagues who, you know, are not getting paid and they don't raise any money, they don't charge any money, they don't give any money, they don't pay any money. It's totally a volunteer thing, but it has this worldwide connection and worldwide reach. So it started out as a way for artists from one country to get to know artists in a different country. So if you were traveling from Canada and you wanted to go to Korea, could you go to Theater Without Borders and they would connect you with a Korean theater artist who could host you there, who could show you around, introduce you to people. And it just became, you know, volunteers popped up all over the world who said, I'd be willing to help theater artists from another country get acclimated to this other place that they wanted to go visit. So you go on their website and there's many, many things to discover about working internationally as a theater artist. That's been really cool. And then a big project we did in 2010 was a conference at La Mama in New York on theater and peace building in conflict zones. And that became like just a touchstone for a lot of people. We said, we have no money to do this. If you want to come, these are the dates. And we ended up with 300 people from about 40 different countries showed up. And it was such an intense time. Everybody needed to talk about this work. It really was a place for people to gather and think about what does it mean to be a theater artist who wants to have an impact in a world where conflict and war and disagreement are so much the fabric of people's lives.
Mama would be very proud.
Yeah, she was around during that. Our most recent project, which your listeners might really be interested to know about, is the Artist Mobility Funding Guide that we put together a year ago, a resource guide of all the places that fund travel for artists, any kind of artist, any kind of travel, but where can you find all that information in one place? So now there's a website, there's over 100 different opportunities listed. Some of them are very specific, you know, specific kinds of work and specific places to travel to. We tried to get all the nonprofits, all the NGOs, all the embassies, anything that we could find where money is being used to help artists travel. Because that becomes the biggest roadblock for a lot of artists when they want to work abroad.
Yeah, that does sound very useful. Just as we wrap up today, David, I'm wondering if you'd give me a list of a couple of those websites that you've talked about. What's the Theater Without Borders one?
T-H-E-A-T-R-E, Without Borders, all one word, theaterwithoutborders.com.
And then La Mama is lamama.org.
Right, lamama.org.
And
right.
davidjdiamond.com is your website.
That's my website.
Yeah, because you do consulting internationally. You don't have to be in the same room.
Right, yeah.
Excellent.
I'll talk to people anywhere.
Well, David, thank you so much for your time today. You've been most generous, as you always are. Generous, beautiful host, just a wonderful, warm presence in any room. And I really appreciate you joining me today.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. It's great to talk to you. I know it's been a little while since we've been in touch, but I'm so glad to reconnect. So thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to the Lisa Lafferty Podcast. This was episode 3. To download other conversations in this series with Brad Fraser, Allison Kelly, Laurel Thompson, Simon David, and Yvette Nolan, go to citr.ca.